thank you, everybody. We are now ready to proceed with our afternoon session. Helen Rushford from the Office of the Public Advocate. Helen is the coordinator of the Advice and Education Service within OPA. She's going to take us through the new Powers of Attorney Act and tell us a little bit about some of the resources that OPA has developed so that people with disability and disability advocates working with people with disability can make best use of the Act. Even though I pay attention to every speaker with all of my energy, Helen, I'm particularly going to pay attention to this presentation because, just to declare a personal interest, a friend of mine who has a mental health condition recently told me that he'd identified me on various bits of paperwork as his next of kin and his emergency contact person, and I went, oh, that's fair enough. But when I further discussed the matter with him, what he really meant was he wanted to make me his medical power of attorney. I thought, whoops. It's one thing to read about these things and provide resources for the sector about powers of attorney, it's another thing to be one. So I'm going to be listening with both ears wide open today, Helen. Will you join me in welcoming Helen Rushford?
Thanks, Robin. It's lovely to be here. I was just saying I've just done a three-hour presentation on powers of attorney this morning and ran from work to here. Well, I didn't run. I came on the tram to here to do this one. I feel certainly for the last 6 months like I live, eat and breathe powers of attorney. So and dream. I do spend a lot of my time, and in fact I'm travelling to Mexico at the end of the year and I've been doing Spanish lessons, and I even had just before the new powers came in, I think I had this after one Spanish class, spent this whole night trying to translate the appointment forms into Spanish when I can barely say hello or, you know, thank you. So it was a complete nightmare, but anyway, I'm a little bit more informed now, so hopefully I'll bring you along with me. Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional custodians of this land. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present and extend that respect to any Aboriginal people here today. Okay, I've got a lot of information to cover. I've made the PowerPoint available, or Robin has it electronically. I'm happy for that to go out to people. I understand I've got an hour. I'll be hard-pressed to get through all the slides in an hour, and I'm happy to really be guided. I'm guessing that people are probably more interested in knowing about the supportive attorney appointments than the enduring powers. Am I right there? Okay, so the supportive attorney information comes earlier in the presentation, so we'll spend as much time as we need on that. I'm happy to answer as many questions as I can, and then I guess we'll leave what's left over. I'll cover what I can with enduring powers. I can come back to do that again but I think it's probably the supportive attorney appointments that is interesting for you guys and certainly interesting for us as an office, you know, being such brand new legislation. So I'm essentially starting with a definition of what is a power of attorney. A power of attorney is a legal document that an adult with decision-making capacity completes, appointing somebody. So that person is known with the new terminology under the Powers of Attorney Act as the principal. So the principal completes a power of attorney document, appointing another adult known as the attorney, with the authority to make decisions on their behalf or now under our new legislation to support them to make their own decisions. So we have both options available under the Powers of Attorney Act. A power of attorney operates while the principal is alive and either wants or needs somebody to make decisions on their behalf or to support them to make decisions. So once the principal dies, the authority of that power of attorney ceases. It operates only while the principal is alive. And it's important to know that every state and territory in Australia has its own laws for powers of attorney. So it's not transferable. Well, there is some recognition between the states, but it's certainly not uniform. So this is just a slide that gives you a snapshot. This is, we've got some sort of transition slides that we're covering, certainly for this year. The new legislation came in on the 1st of September. So at the moment, people sort of have a sense of, well, I know what used to be in place, so what's in place now? So we're providing that comparison at the moment. So before the 1st of September, the laws that we had in place around powers of attorney were, we had the Instruments Act of 1958, and that gave us the provisions for a general power of attorney and an enduring power of attorney financial. We also have the Guardianship and Administration Act that provided us with an enduring power of guardianship. And the Medical Treatment Act is the law that covers the enduring power of attorney for medical treatment. Now you'll see from that slide that's from the 1st of September, we've got new laws in place. But there's been no change to the medical enduring power of attorney. So that was not included in the review of powers of attorney. This review of the laws commenced about 7 years ago. It was under the Brumby government. That's how long ago it was. So law reform is a very long, slow process. But in their wisdom, when they started the review, the government decided not to include the medical enduring power of attorney as part of that review. So there's been no change whatsoever to that. But what you can see, what we have in place now is the Powers of Attorney Act 2014. And what that gives us is a general non-enduring power of attorney, supportive attorney appointments for personal and or financial matters, and one enduring power of attorney for personal and or financial matters. So all of those are now covered in the one legislation, and then you'll see that the medical enduring power of attorney remains as is. As I said, no change to that, and it sits under the Medical Treatment Act of 1988. The current government is actually conducting an end of life, a review on end of life decisions and laws around that. So we are hopeful that we might see some law reform in that area as well in the next few years. Now, the legislation gives us, I guess it's fair to say that with this new law, the new Power of Attorney Act, there has been an attempt, I guess, to give it more of a human rights framework. And it certainly gives us some good and useful guiding principles and statements. One of those is around decision-making capacity. And the legislation makes it quite clear that every person is presumed to have decision-making capacity unless there is evidence to the contrary. So it's a bit like the presumption of innocence. We're all assumed innocent until we're proven guilty of a crime. In the same way, all adults are presumed to have the capacity to make their own decisions unless there is some evidence that says that somebody doesn't have that capacity. So that's the starting point, and that's clearly the framework for this legislation. It's also important to remember that people's capacity to make decisions lack of decision-making capacity, I should say, may be temporary. It doesn't have to be a permanent situation. So that can happen to anybody from an accident or an illness. I've spoken to many people in my 10 years on the advice service where, you know, a family member's been, you know, struck down by some seemingly benign illness that has then, you know, progressed and resulted in them being unconscious in hospital or in an induced coma or from an accident. So in those sorts of situations, if somebody's not able to indicate their wishes, then clearly any legal frameworks that we have that deal with what happens when somebody can't make decisions applies equally to somebody in that temporary situation as it does to somebody who has a permanent disability or permanent incapacity. Again, the legislation talks a lot about the importance of providing people with practicable support to be able to make their own decisions. So it is very much about not only in relation to supportive attorney appointments, but even with enduring appointments where somebody is there to make decisions on behalf of another person who can't, there still is an expectation that the principal, the person who's appointed them, is involved, is supported to make their own decisions as much as possible and is involved in any decisions that are being made to the you know, as those circumstances allow. So again, important for people who are appointed in those roles to understand that that's how this legislation works. It's also important that assumptions about a person's, and I'm sure this is something I don't have to tell any of you, that assumptions about a person's capacity to make decisions should not be based on appearance or on the decision that a person is making. So we're all entitled to make whatever decisions we want, however bad, foolish, unwise other people consider them to be. And, you know, that's a right that we all have. And this legislation expresses that. It says that it's not about making a bad decision. It's about, you know, that somebody can only make decisions on your behalf if you are unable to make those decisions for yourself. So they're important, you know, guiding principles, I guess. The legislation also talks about, well, What do you need to consider when you're looking at somebody's capacity to make decisions? And it highlights a number of key points, and that is that for somebody to be able to have decision-making capacity, they need to understand the information that's relevant to the decision, to making that decision, and to understand the information about the effect of, relevant to the effect of that decision. So what do I need to know to make this decision, and what do I need to know about what will happen if I make that decision? A person needs also to be able to retain that information to the extent necessary to make the decision. They need to be able to use or weigh up that information, a process of evaluation. What happens if I do this? This is the likely outcome. Or if I do this, this is the likely outcome. So for somebody to demonstrate they have capacity to make decision, they need to be able to use and weigh up that information. And lastly, they need to be able to communicate their decision in some way, including by speech, gestures, or other means. So it's only really when somebody does not have any means of communicating. Again, we're talking about somebody who's unconscious or in a coma, who has no means of communicating their wishes at all, that you would consider that they, you know, they would not have, you know, that would be one way of saying that they do not have decision-making capacity. Please ask questions. Is that somebody was going to have a mic? Oh, Pauline, no, Pauline hasn't got the microphone. So I'm happy for people to ask questions as we go along if there's anything that's not making sense or you want clarification or you want to make a comment on that. Oh.
Helen, it's George from the Youth Disability Advocacy Service.
Yes, George.
You mentioned personal and financial.
Yep.
And then there's medical, so there's those three.
Yes.
Personal, can you maybe talk about what you mean by personal?
Yes. So basically what the legislation says is that personal matters is anything, any matters that relate to the principal's personal or lifestyle affairs. And it provides some examples such as making decisions about healthcare, making decisions about where somebody would live, their day-to-day activities, who they have contact with. So there's some examples, but essentially anything that would be considered a personal decision could be made by an enduring power of attorney for personal matters.
So you said healthcare.
This is where our laws get, where, as I said, you know, we've missed in the fact that they chose not to include the medical enduring power of attorney in the review. We still have some overlap between the two. And if you're happy to hold that question, I'll get to that. I'll explain an enduring attorney for personal matters, what sort of authority they have, and as opposed to somebody who is a medical agent under a medical enduring power of attorney. Yep.
Fiona Tipping from Grampians Disability Advocacy. Just on practical terms, only because it's a case that's come up with me a couple of times, does it mean that somebody... previously, I've had a couple of cases where people were denied the right to legal representation because the then legal guardian said that they didn't want them to have it, or the right to advocacy. Now, it was taken up by the Office of the Public Advocate, so I'm just wondering, that was supposed to be reviewed to change that?
Certainly the definition of... so when we talk about... so for both supportive attorney appointments and enduring appointments, they can be made for both personal and or financial matters. And the definition of financial matters is any matter relating to the principal's finances or property, including any legal matters that relate to that. And the same with personal, any matters relating to the principal's personal or lifestyle matters, including any legal matters that may relate to the person's personal. So that, for instance, could be around an intervention order. That's a legal matter that deals, a legal issue that deals with a personal matter. So a supportive attorney could be involved in supporting the principal around those decisions. An enduring attorney for personal matters could make those decisions on behalf of the principal. I don't think anybody, I don't think any substitute decision maker has the right to deny another person access to legal support, information, you know. So, yeah, okay. All right. Oh, yes, sorry, go on.
Can I just ask, is this doing away completely with guardianship? Oh, there's no guardianship?
No, there is still guardianship. So what we're talking about, as I said at the start, a power of attorney is a legal document that an adult with capacity makes. So you have to be able to do these things, okay? And so if you can do these things, you can potentially put a power of attorney, you can make a power of attorney yourself to put in place somebody that you want to be able to make decisions for you or support you to make decisions when, you know, either you can't or whether when you want them to do that. Guardianship orders are made when a person has a disability and that disability means that they're unable to make reasonable decisions for themselves. So there has to be some evidence about the fact that the person lacks decision-making capacity. And so those applications go to VCAT and VCAT look for that supporting evidence to say, to be clear about that the person has a disability under the Guardianship and Administration Act, and that can be an intellectual disability, an acquired brain injury, a physical disability, mental illness or dementia. So that's the definition of disability under the Guardianship and Administration Act. So for an order, a guardianship or an administration order to be made, there needs to be evidence that somebody has one of those disabilities and that that disability affects the person's ability to be able to make reasonable decisions for themselves. So because of their disability, they can't do these things. And that there's a current issue that needs, a current decision that needs to be made that can't be made any other way.
Sorry, it was just sounding like the guardianship.
No, guardianship is still there, very much. So this, I mean, in a way, at the office, we spend a lot of time talking about powers of attorney because it's almost like a demand management strategy for us. If people, while they're competent, make these appointments and make them and spend time thinking about planning, choosing the right people to appoint, then if the situation arises that they can't make decisions for themselves, they've already named somebody who can make those decisions for them, and then those matters don't have to go to VCAT. So that's the idea. If you get the right person in place, if you make it, you know, if you spend time thinking about what you want, whether you want somebody, who you want to appoint, what sort of decisions you want them to make, and that's clearly spelt out in the appointment form, in theory, that should reduce the need for applications to VCAT, in theory. That's right. Okay, let's talk about, I'm not going to spend any time talking about a general non-enduring power of attorney because it's not enduring, as the name suggests. So it is a document that allows the principal to appoint somebody to make financial and some legal decisions on their behalf. It tends to be the sort of document that people make if they're going overseas and they want to have somebody here who can sort out any banking issues or anything like that. It only operates while the principal has capacity to give instruction and direction to the person that they've appointed. So it's not about future planning. It's really about, you know, people use it a lot in business when they need somebody else to undertake, you know, financial and some legal activities on their behalf. Supportive attorney appointments. Now, I'll do this as a summary of what current powers of attorney are available now, and then I'm going to talk in more detail about the supportive attorney appointments, and you can ask me as many questions as you like then. It is also not enduring. So if you think about it logically, so the purpose of a supportive attorney appointment is to support the principal to be able to make their own decisions. So it stands to reason if the principal can't make decisions, the supportive attorney can't act, because the supportive attorney isn't making decisions for the principal. They're supporting the principal to make their own decisions, and there are various ways that they can do that. So it can only operate while the principal is able to make those decisions for which they want their supportive attorney to support. There's a variety of, I'm not going to go into too much of the detail of how many people you can appoint and in what ways. I've bought some booklets with me, and I'll talk at the end about the sort of resources that we have available, but there are some here, and if I tell you, you won't remember anyway, so better off that you read it at a later point. But just, there are choices. The enduring power of attorney. As I said, one enduring power of attorney that allows for the appointment of an attorney for personal or financial matters, or both personal and financial matters in the one form. Now, this does endure. So for all of these, all powers of attorney, the person has to have capacity to make them. But an enduring power of attorney, the authority of that person who's appointed continues or endures when the principal loses capacity to make their own decisions. And then the enduring attorney steps into their shoes and makes decisions on their behalf. And then the medical enduring power of attorney, a separate document that allows for the appointment of somebody to make medical treatment decisions only. So that's only decisions that are made by a medical practitioner or a doctor. So, you know, it's about, you know, and again, I've got the detail on the slide, but it's about sort of, you know, medical treatment, not physio or, you know, nursing services, all those sorts of things. It's about treatment that's being offered by a medical practitioner or a dentist. Okay, now let's talk about supportive attorney appointments. So, this is brand new legislation, not only for Victoria, but it's the first of its kind in Australia. So it's really exciting for us to be, you know, involved in this. There's a lot that we don't know. I can talk to you about, you know, what the law says and what it's designed to do, but because it is new and it's not operating anywhere else in Australia, there are lots of things that are a bit unknown about how it's actually going to roll out. What we do know is that the intention of this legislation was to allow people with disability the opportunity to exercise their rights to make their own decisions with support. When you read the second reading speech of the then Attorney General Robert Clark, when the legislation was introduced in Parliament, he makes it quite clear that that was the intent behind this legislation, so that for people who might, because of a disability, might not have been able to make an enduring power of attorney, or who might not have wanted to, you know, make that, but in fact were looking for somebody who could support them, formally support them to make decisions, that that's the intention of this legislation. However, it is open to anybody, any adult over the age of 18 who might see this as a useful tool can make that. So it's not just limited to people with disabilities. It's anybody who wants to, who considers that, you know, there's a reason for them making a supportive attorney appointment can make that. As I've said, it allows the principal to appoint somebody who can support their decisions. So quite a different idea from an enduring power of attorney, which is about substitute decision making. And while we know that a lot of people have informal arrangements in place already, what this provides is a formal legal arrangement, and that can be useful for having the person in the support role recognised. There is now a legal framework that says, yes, this person has the authority to do this. This is what the legislation tells us, that somebody needs to be able to understand to make a supportive attorney appointment. And that is that that the principal understands that the appointment enables them to have somebody to support them, to appoint somebody to support them to make their decisions. That they can choose the person to support them, that that's their choice, and that that role of that person is to support them to make decisions. That the supported decisions are the principal's decisions. They're not the decisions of the supportive attorney, they're the principal's decisions. The principal needs to understand, anybody making this needs to understand when the appointment commences and that they have some choice in that. They can decide when the appointment commences and that they can revoke the appointment at any time while they still have the capacity to do so. So if an individual, an adult, can understand these matters, they can make an injury. And then if you remember back to that other overarching, that sort of broad decision-making capacity slide where I talked about somebody needs to be able to communicate their decisions in some way, needs to be able to retain that information, needs to be able to evaluate. So they need to be able to do that. And then specifically in relation to the supportive attorney appointment, they need to be able to understand these matters. Does that make sense to people? Yes? No? Yes? Yep. Okay, great. Now, there's a range of options with these appointments. About people can choose, they can choose more than one person to appoint as their supportive attorney. They can choose whether they appoint somebody for financial matters or personal matters or both. They can choose when the appointment starts, and there are some legal requirements around the form. It has to be witnessed. There are formal witnessing requirements. The person being appointed as the supportive attorney has to formally accept their appointment. So all of that information you'll find in the booklet that I've brought along here. It's interesting, what we don't know, as I said, the intent of the legislation was really around people with existing disabilities being able to appoint people to support them. But in the education sessions, as I said, you know, it's new information and we don't really know who's going to take up these appointments. And it will be interesting for us to see, you know, how that rolls out over the next 12 months. I know I've done quite a lot of sessions in the last month or so with general, you know, community audiences, and a lot of those audiences we tend to, our sort of target group tends to be older people. Well, we don't target them, but it's older people who are interested in these sorts of matters. And what I've found is that there are actually quite a lot of those people who are really interested in this idea. And particularly, I guess we all know that there's, you know, what's bordering on a dementia epidemic in Australia and certainly, or around the world. And certainly what we know at the Office of the Public Advocate is that for those clients for whom we are appointed as guardian, the vast majority are people who have acquired a disability during their lifetime, and of those, the biggest group is people with dementia. And dementia, as you know, is a progressive illness. So what a number of people are interested in is the idea that perhaps, you know, if they were diagnosed with a progressive illness such as dementia or motor neurone, multiple sclerosis, that at the early stages of those of that diagnosis, that they, and particularly if they're, you know, really wanting to retain autonomy around their decision making, that they can envisage that they would make a supportive attorney appointment to have somebody to support them to make decisions while they still have capacity, but, you know, might need support in a variety of ways. And then they may also make, knowing that that's a degenerative disease and that they are likely to get to a point where they're going to be unable to make decisions for themselves, that they will also make enduring powers of attorney. So it's like a continuum. So they've got somebody, and, you know, that's something that anybody could consider, that they've got somebody to support them to make decisions while they can make those decisions, but they've also named who they would want to be as their substitute decision maker should they get to the point where they're unable to make decisions for themselves. So as I say, it will be, you know, it will be really interesting to see who does take up these appointments, how well they work, and how they're used. That, as I said, I can talk to you about what the law allows, but in fact how they're used, we don't, how they're going to be used, we don't really know. So with the supportive attorney appointment, having decided, the principal having decided who they want to appoint, how many people they want to appoint, and whether they've got, you know, they want support around personal matters or financial matters, they can then decide what sort of power to give to their supportive attorney. And the law gives three options. And so the principal can decide, can give their supportive attorney any one or any combination of these three, and that is, the three powers are information power, so that allows the supportive attorney to access or disclose information on behalf of the principal or assist the principal to access or disclose information. Communication power, which gives the supportive attorney the authority to communicate decisions on behalf of the principal or assist the principal to communicate their decisions. And the third power is the power to give effect to decisions. We tend to refer to it as the power to make it happen. And that can be anything. It's very broad, it's not defined, and but the legislation says that it's anything else that is required to give effect to a decision, to make a decision happen. So that might be attending a meeting with the principal or on behalf of the principal. It might be for somebody who's physically unable to sign, it might involve signing documentation. So it, as I said, it's not defined, and it's sort of really open to see how people use that last power. So when a principal is making a decision, they need to decide what sort of power they want their supportive attorney to have.
I noticed you moved to the next slide, but at the bottom you've got something involved.
Yes, I said supportive attorneys cannot be involved in significant financial transactions.
Yeah, can you explain?
Which are?
Oh, good. Thanks.
So, and this is, you know, I have to say, this is a sort of somewhat an area of concern, and where it's a bit, you know, where perhaps it's a bit loose, there might need to be some law reform. We might see, I think we probably are hoping that there might be some law reform. So I'll talk to you about what we can already see as the potential pitfalls with this. So So a supportive attorney cannot be, the legislation says, cannot be involved in significant financial transactions. And that's defined as, or it includes, it's not limited to this, but these are the key areas. Buying or selling a house or other property. Entering into a secured loan. Most investments. Now, one of the issues about the investments is that it's investments over $10,000. So that's a big amount. So that means that they could be involved in some investments that were worth less than $10,000. And that investments also includes deposits at a registered financial deposit taking institution, in other words, a bank. So it means, you know, in theory, it means that a supportive attorney could be involved in financial matters, you know, with bank accounts, as long as it was less than $10,000. And buying or selling significant personal property. So that they're most of the definitions. One of the things we've actually already asked for, asked the government, the Parliamentary Council for advice on that $10,000 limit is if you had a support, is it cumulative? So if you had a supportive attorney who went to the bank today and dealt with a transaction that was worth, involved $4,000, withdrew that money, for instance, and then they went back to the bank on Monday and made another transaction, say moved, dealt with money of $6,000, and then they went back the week later and dealt with another transaction that was worth $8,000, it's all under that $10,000 limit, is the $10,000 cumulative, and over what period of time, and who makes that decision? Because of course it doesn't, you know, I mean, what we know about our lawmakers is they're not thinking necessarily in practical terms. So we've asked for advice about that. We haven't got it yet. That was a little while ago, a number of weeks ago, that we raised that issue and that we haven't got any advice back about that. The other thing is that, so buying or selling significant personal property, there's no dollar amount given to that. Does the $10,000 apply to that? So there are some issues around this, and again, it's a matter of, you know, we'll just have to see how it plays out. What we also know is that VCAT has an oversight role in relation to supportive attorney appointments, in the same way that they do if people have concerns about the way an enduring power of attorney is operating. But given that VCAT usually deal with matters when a principal doesn't have capacity to make decisions for themselves, and a supportive attorney appointment can only operate while a principal does have capacity, we're not quite sure about, if somebody had a query, is this a significant financial transaction or not, and they took it to VCAT, whether VCAT would deal with that. So there's lots of those things that we really just have to wait and see how that plays out, I think. As I keep saying, it's new to everybody, and it will be a bit of sort of trial and error, I guess. There are some restrictions on who can be appointed as a supportive attorney. And there are also restrictions on who can witness supportive attorney appointments. So in terms of who can be appointed as a supportive attorney, a supportive attorney cannot be somebody who is bankrupt, and it also cannot be a care provider, an accommodation provider, or a health provider for the principal.
Question, can it be an advocate?
Probably, unless you were, if you worked, you know, if you worked in a health service, you'd probably be considered a health provider because of who your employer was. So you couldn't be. I mean, we've had the discussion. I think it could be an advocate, and in fact, we've had discussions at OPA about. But in those instances where, not where we're guardian for people, but where we take up individual advocacy matters, that there might be some value in those situations of having a formal supportive attorney appointment. So a care provider is really somebody who's providing, you know, like your home care worker or personal care worker, those sorts of things. So I could see, yes, that an advocate could. Yeah.
Thank you.
A supportive attorney appointed for financial matters also cannot be appointed if they have been convicted or found guilty of a dishonesty offence unless they disclose that in the document, in the appointment form. So when you look at the appointment form, which is in our booklets, you will see that there's a tick box that says, you know, I have disclosed to the principal that I've been convicted. They don't have to say what the offence is, just that they have been convicted of a dishonesty or fraud offence, and then they can be appointed as supportive attorney. However, if somebody appointed somebody as their supportive attorney and then they were convicted of a dishonesty or fraud offence, then they would no longer be eligible and that appointment would end. But then, as somebody pointed out this morning, you could redo your supportive attorney appointment and appoint them again as long as they tick the box now that they have been disclosed and have been found guilty. But there are duties and obligations laid out in the Act of a supportive attorney, and that is that they must act honestly, diligently and in good faith, exercise reasonable skill and care, not use the position for profit, avoid acting where there is or may be a conflict of interest, and discuss anything about a supported decision with the principal in a way the principal will understand and that will help the principal make the decision. So when somebody signs their statement of acceptance saying that they're happy to take on the appointment as a supportive attorney, they sign that they are willing to carry out the duties and obligations as laid out in the legislation. So this is what that refers to. Any questions? You just need your own microphone, George.
I'm interested in how this relates to laws around next of kin, because I'll just explain the situation. So we have a client who's 22, doesn't have a guardian appointed, but she's often unwell and is in and out of hospital.
Yep.
And it seemed, I found it odd that there was no formal medical power of attorney, and in fact the doctors just, you know, ask the parents what to do and no one really makes an effort to find out what the young person themselves want.
Okay. So the next of kin is not a legal term, but what we do have under the Guardianship and Administration Act is person responsible provisions. And they only relate to healthcare. Okay, so there's a hierarchy. And when one of the booklets that I've put out the back, on the table, it's probably the front actually, is our Take Control book that deals with enduring powers of attorney. And we've also got a page in there about medical decision making. But I haven't bought a lot of those because I didn't think there would be as much interest. You can get them. All the information is on our website, and the books can be ordered as well in hard copy, and they're available for download. But essentially, in relation to healthcare, if any doctor who's providing medical treatment must have the consent of the patient. And if a patient is not able to consent, so that's step one. You know, can the patient consent to this decision? So there might be, in the client that you're talking about, there might be sometimes, depending on what her health issues are, there might be times that she is able to consent to a decision and other times when she's not. And it will also just depend on what the decision is. So there will be people who would have the capacity to consent to a more simple decision about, will I have a blood test? The doctor's suggesting you have a blood test, you haven't been feeling well, you've been really tired, run down, let's have a blood test, see what's going on. The patient said, yes, that's fine. Then the blood test comes back and it shows that the patient has leukemia. and there needs to be all sorts of more complex decisions made about treatment, etc., it may be that that patient might not be able to make those decisions about treatment. So if a doctor determines that a patient is not able to provide informed consent, they must then look for who is the person responsible. And that's the term that's used under the Guardianship and Administration Act. And that's a hierarchy. So the first few positions on that list are people who are appointed in that role. So the very top of the list is somebody who is appointed as a medical agent under an enduring power of attorney for medical treatment. Second, I should know it off the top of my head, but I don't. Second, I think, is... Second is a person appointed by VCAT to make medical decisions. Third is a guardian appointed by VCAT. Fourth is a person appointed as an enduring power of attorney for personal matters, is fourth on the list. Then it's a person appointed by the person in writing. Then we get to people who are in that position by virtue of their relationship with the patient. So spouse or domestic partner, primary carer, and then we go to nearest relative, and then there's a hierarchy within that as well. And it only goes as far as aunt and uncle, niece and nephew. So in my case, I've made my enduring power of attorney for medical treatment, and I've named my sister, who is a nurse, because I figured she'd be better able to stand up to the doctors. So she's number one for me, and my partner, he doesn't get a Guernsey because he's in at number five. It doesn't matter what he thinks. It's my choice. But that was my decision. And so that's a good reason for somebody making enduring powers of attorney, particularly for medical treatment. If you want to have somebody who's not on that list, or you want to have somebody, you want to elevate somebody from the bottom of that list. In my family, for my parents, I was the youngest of eight. I was never going to get a look in, because it does for siblings, for, you know, son and daughter siblings, it's age oldest first. So, you know, if my parents had have wanted me to be their medical decision maker, they would have needed to appoint me as their medical agent to get me higher up the list. So that's really good reasons for people making enduring powers of attorney. However, supportive attorney appointments don't apply here, because the person responsible provisions are only when a patient cannot make that decision themselves. A supportive attorney can only support somebody to make decisions. So using your client as an example, let's say, for instance, she does have the capacity to make a supportive attorney appointment, and knowing that she has a lot of health issues, she actually wants somebody to be able to support her. It might be about communicating decisions with the doctor. It might be helping her understand information. It might simply be having somebody to attend appointments with her. And it might be that she's got a really close friend, or it might be a sibling rather than her parents that she would want to have involved in that supportive role. So she could appoint somebody as her supportive attorney to be able to support her, and in that way perhaps encourage the clinicians, the doctors, to be dealing with her about her own issues, her own health issues, rather than going to her parents. But then if she was unwell, so let's say she became really unwell and was in hospital, and there was... The doctor felt that she couldn't give informed consent to that decision, well, then there would be no role for her supportive attorney at that point, because she can't make that decision. And then then they would need to look at who was first on that list of person responsible who could make a substitute medical decision for her. Does that help clarify that?
Yeah, that certainly does. I just want to comment I'd add to that is that I've found that doctors often don't ask the person with a disability.
Absolutely.
We'll go straight to the parent or
yep,
the...
couldn't yeah, agree more. And even, and the Guardianship and Administration Act in relation to person responsible clearly states that a person responsible in making a decision must take into effect the wishes of the patient. So, you know, even if you have got somebody who's making... you know, who's in that position because the doctors have said, and I agree with you, often they'll say, oh, it's easier, let's just get the parents rather than spend time, you know, trying to communicate with somebody with a disability or whatever it might be. But even with the parents, they should still, whoever the person responsible is, should still be, first thing, what does the patient want? What are their views, wishes, preferences, values, beliefs, all of those sorts of things. But we know in practice that that doesn't always happen. Now, I'm aware that... Oh, yes?
Helen, can I just ask, if yep, you've prepared yourself and you've put an enduring power of attorney in place, but you're using a support attorney...
Yep.
..and something happens that you didn't predict and the hierarchy is turned yep, to, will your support decision-maker be involved at all, or will they go to the power of attorney?
No, if the principal can't make a decision, then there's no role for the supportive attorney. Yeah. And for some people that might be temporary, and then but then if the supportive attorney, so you know, one example that's come up is say somebody with mental health issues who may say, for instance, for example, suffered depression and anxiety, and they might decide to appoint that a supportive attorney would be really useful because they know when they have to deal with service providers or, you know, phone companies or whatever it might be, that that produces, you know, significant anxiety for them. They get really stressed. They struggle to do it. So so they might appoint a supportive attorney and, you know, talk with the supportive attorney about the sorts of decisions they want them to support. But then if they experienced a period of significant depression, for instance, and were perhaps admitted, you know, as a compulsory patient under the Mental Health Act, and were deemed then not able to make decisions, while that was occurring, there would be no role for the supportive attorney. So that's the but it doesn't mean that they don't, it would only be if the principal lost capacity permanently that that appointment would stop altogether. But at any point at which the principal can't make a decision, the supportive attorney can't act because it relies on the principal making that decision. Is that, does that, yeah, is that clear?
That yeah, helps, thanks.
All right. I'm going to quickly whip through the enduring attorney because I'm just about out of time. And I've covered a lot of this anyway. So one document that allows for the appointment of somebody for financial matters or and personal matters, or either or, personal matters or both. As we've talked about, financial matters really relates to anything to do with the principal's finances or property, including things like paying expenses, making investments, real estate transactions, etc. Now, personal matters is any matter relating to the principal's personal or lifestyle affairs, including healthcare matters. Now, just to clarify the difference between an attorney appointed for personal matters and an attorney appointed as a medical agent under a medical enduring power of attorney, an attorney appointed for personal matters can consent to treatment. The important thing is if somebody wants to have somebody in place who has the legal authority to refuse treatment on their behalf, they must also make an enduring power of attorney for medical treatment, because it is only a medical power of attorney that can refuse treatment. If somebody has both in place, as we talked about, that person responsible hierarchy, so in my case, I've done it under the old laws, but I've got all three powers of attorney in place. So I've got my medical agent under a medical power of attorney. I've got an enduring guardian under an enduring power of guardianship. So replace that with an enduring attorney for personal matters, and I've got a financial. So if I need somebody to make a healthcare decision for me, it's my medical agent. They take precedence. They're number one on that list. If I didn't have a medical agent, it would be my enduring guardian or my enduring attorney for personal matters. So it depends what you've got in place. So our message to people really is, if you want to appoint somebody to make all sorts of personal decisions for you, such as, you know, where you live, what sort of services you get, who you have contact with, and your healthcare, appoint an enduring power of attorney for personal matters. But if it's also important to you to have somebody who can refuse treatment, you must make a medical enduring power of attorney as well. If you say, no, I don't want, it's a bridge too far for me to think that somebody would have the power to refuse treatment on my behalf, then you don't need the medical. You can just make the enduring power of attorney for personal treatment, because they can consent to treatment, but they can't refuse it for you. So again, it's very much an individual matter. Our laws, and especially these laws, give people lots of choices now about who to appoint, how many to appoint, in what way you appoint them, how they can act, when they can act. And so people need to really think about this before they get to the forms. If you get to the forms and you haven't thought all of that through, you'll be completely bamboozled. Now, we talked before about a supportive attorney. For somebody to make a supportive attorney appointment, they had to understand certain things, you know, that the decisions were theirs, that the person supported them to make decisions. It's a different test for an enduring power of attorney. It's not necessarily harder, but it's different. So for somebody to be able to make an enduring power of attorney, they have to understand these things. And some of the key things in that, so they need to understand that they can set conditions and limitations for their attorney and give instructions. They need to understand when the power commences and that they have a choice in that. It can commence immediately. It can commence only when they lose capacity. That the attorney has the same power as the principal for the matters in which they've been appointed. So if the principal can't make decisions, the attorney can. So that's an important distinction. The principal needs to understand that the power of the attorney continues if they lose capacity, that they can revoke the power while they have the capacity to do so, but that if they lose capacity, they will be unable to oversee the use of the power. So that's why it's so important to get the right person and somebody that you can trust to do that. As I said, there are a number of different ways in which you can set up a power of attorney. You can appoint more than one attorney, and if you're appointing more than one, you can appoint them jointly means they must act together, severally they act individually, jointly and severally they can do both. By majority means that if you appoint more than two, so if you appoint three or four, there has to be a majority who agree before a decision can be made. And let me tell you, the general community love that. They go, great, now I can appoint all my five of my children and three of them have to agree before a decision. And I just think, yep, recipe for disaster. So there are witnessing requirements. The attorney must formally accept the appointment and, has to be witnessed. So all of that information is on the website or in Take Control. Again, the same sorts of limitations, the same sorts of exclusions for who can be an attorney. So under an enduring power of attorney, they also cannot be bankrupt, care provider, accommodation provider, health provider, and the same dishonesty disclosure applies as well. Now, the legislation gives us some nice frameworks or guiding principles, again, for the way that the attorney should be acting if they're making decisions when the principal doesn't have capacity. And that is that they must do so in a way that is as least restrictive of the principal's ability to decide and act as is possible in the circumstances, and to ensure that the principal is given practicable and appropriate support to enable them to participate in decisions that affect them. It also talks about taking reasonable steps to encourage the principal to participate, giving a practicable and appropriate effect to the principal's wishes. And acting in a way that promotes the personal and social well-being of the principal, including by recognising the inherent dignity of the principal, considering the principal's existing supportive relationships, religion, values and cultural and linguistic needs, and respecting the confidentiality of the principal. So again, when an enduring attorney signs their statement of acceptance, this is what they're signing up for. They're saying, yes, I'm going to do all these things. And I think it's particularly when you look at, when we look now at the medical enduring power of attorney, where there's been no change to that, and that was law that was drawn up in 1988, it seems very lacking. It doesn't provide us with any of this sort of framework or guidance. So it's good that, you know, that this has been included in the laws. I'm over time, so there's probably all the information. I'd probably rather, you know, take any questions that people have just to finish off. There is information in the slides about the medical power of attorney as well. So any last questions before I finish? No? Okay. I'll just remind people that if you're confused by all of this, we have a very skilled and knowledgeable, currently very tired. We've been dealing with about an 85% increase in our calls since the new laws came in, and no comparable increase in staff. So we're all a little bit worn out, but so we have workers on our advice service who are happy to talk with you about any of these issues and give you advice. We've got something happened to my. I'm missing a slide, but anyway, we've got a range of resources that are available. We've got a booklet on making supportive attorneys, so that's called Side by Side. I seem to have lost that slide somewhere. So Side by Side is a brand new guide that deals with supportive attorney appointments. It also has the appointment form in it. It also has an easy English guide in that within that document as well, that's on a perforated page, so that can be torn out. And then we have Take Control, which is our guide for enduring powers of attorney. Again, it has the appointment form and it has all the information about enduring powers of attorney. And we've also got brochures. So I brought with me today the Take Control, the Side by Side, and the Powers of Attorney brochure, and they're all available to be ordered in hard copy through Victoria Legal Aid in bulk, small quantities through our office, and all available for... actually, the brochures are not downloadable on the website because they're gatefolds. They don't print off very well, but you can order them in hard copy and all the information is available on the website. So thank you for your time. I hope that was useful.
Thank you. Thanks, Helen. Helen Rushford, who's the Coordinator, Advice and Education Services Unit at... Advice and Education Service at OPA. Thanks so much. That was really comprehensive. And if you rush out now to the registration desk, you'll be able to get some copies of those documents. But as Helen mentioned, they are resources available on the OPA website. As per our standard practice after every Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum, any resources that are mentioned by any of our speakers will provide links to those resources in the post-forum resource that is emailed out to everybody who has registered for today's forum. So if you've come today and you haven't registered, make sure you get in touch with Natasha so that we do have your current email contact details. Helen, thank you so much. Pleasure. That was fabulous. A hell of a lot to digest, and so it's great that there's so many resources. But I'm a little bit scared now. Thank you.